Hello, everyone. Pete Davis here. Welcome to a special bonus episode of Current Affairs. I am here with Chuck Marone. Hello, Chuck.
Hey, Pete. Nice to talk to you.
So glad to have you on. You are the founder and president of Strong Towns, a nonprofit advocating for models of city planning and development that allow for financially strong and resilient cities, towns, and neighborhoods. And for the listeners out there, Chuck is not just pontificating about this subject from nowhere. He is a professional engineer licensed in Minnesota. He's a member of the American Institute of Certified Planners. Those meetings must be very exciting, the annual conference of the American Institute of Certified Planners. And he has been named one of the 10 most influential urbanists of all time by Plan Netizen. I wanted to have you on the show today, Chuck, because we spend so much time on this show talking about national politics, but the politics that probably affect our life just as much are the politics and design of our neighborhoods, towns, and cities. For listeners out there, if we had Medicare for all and a Green New Deal, but all of our towns turned into Walmart parking lots or ugly office parks, we'd still be in trouble. So I wanted you to hear from Chuck, who, in my opinion, is one of the most exciting American thinkers out there today. Welcome, Chuck.
Thanks, Pete. And I got to say, I was always told that I would like you. Like, we have friends in common and they're like, oh, you would like this Pete Davis guy. And I'm like, okay, you know, like, I really like you. You know, we got to meet a little bit when I was at Harvard giving a talk and you did a great introduction. But then I heard your commencement address and I thought, this is amazing. And I've heard other stuff you've done and I'm deeply impressed with you. You're a cool guy.
Oh, Chuck. Well, this is wonderful. I'm very touched and coming from you. It's an honor. I have been following Strong Towns for 5 years, but I've never heard yet the origin story. What is it that got you into this cause? And, you know, you do a lot of one-to-one organizing. You've built this step by step as a big national network. So I'm sure you've had to tell this origin story so many times, but I think many of our listeners are hearing for you for the first time. So what is the story of Strong Towns?
Well, I was a really bad engineer who went back to school and got a planning degree because I thought that would help me. And I became a really bad planner. And by a bad engineer, bad planner, I mean, I asked too many questions, right? A good engineer, there's a rule book for you to follow. And a lot of it is applying these rules. And that's not how engineering is kind of sold to you as a student. It's sold as, you know, you're using your brain to solve problems. But the reality is working for a city, most problems have been solved. You're just, you know, how wide do you make this street? How deep do you make this pipe? Those have been worked out for thousands of years. You're just applying, you know, known things. And I just asked too many questions, right? Like, so I had a hard time fitting in. When I was in grad school, I wound up starting my own company. And so I did planning for cities all over the state. Cities that I had worked with as an engineer started to call me. And by the time I got out of grad school, I had hired two of my fellow classmates to help me. At one point, we had 5 offices and 13 staff. We were the city planner for 75 different cities all over the state of Minnesota. And we were working in the middle of this boom, doing new subdivisions and new developments all over the place, building new homes. And I'm not going to claim that I saw the housing crisis coming because I didn't. I didn't understand that part of it. But I knew that our cities were crazy. I knew that things were nuts.
A decade of the cul-de-sac.
Oh, yeah. I would show up at these meetings and I would have like data saying like, look, we're doing this and this doesn't make any sense for us. As the planner for this city, if this development works out perfectly, which I have serious doubts, we are still going to take it in the shorts financially. Like, this is not going to work out for us. And over and over and over again, these cities would tell me, Chuck, just shut up and do your job. You know, your job is to process the permit. We do the deep thinking. You know, we know what's going on. Tell us that the lines on the paper are right and that, you know, we're not going to get in any problems. By the time we got to 2008 and banks were failing and, you know, things were falling apart, I had been yelling like the sky is falling for like 2 or 3 years. And so literally Strong Town started as me in November of 2008, after the election of Barack Obama, sitting down to write a blog, feeling like I was all alone, a voice in the wilderness. Everyone that I knew and that I worked with thought I was crazy. The cities that I've been advising hated me. And I literally sat down and I told my wife, I said, I think it's cheaper than therapy, right? Like, if I sit down and and just write about what I'm seeing, I'm going to get these thoughts out of my head. And if I'm crazy, I'm crazy. But I at least want to make the case. And people started to read it and pass it around. And after a short period of time, some friends of mine said, you need to start a nonprofit. I told them, forget it. They said, we'll fill out the paperwork. You just keep writing. And they did. They filled out the paperwork and sent in the 501c3. And a year later, we had our IRS designation. And a few months after that, a foundation in Minnesota actually contacted me, said, we're really fascinating your work. Come and tell us what you do. And I'm like, I don't do anything. I just write. I write 3 days a week. They gave me 3 years of startup money to leave my planning firm. And the only condition they had on me is that I go out and share this message with as many places as I can. And that's what I've been doing full time since 2012.
Well, this is a very heartwarming story that we really appreciate at Current Affairs, because you angry blogged your way towards a new world, you know, as a magazine where we sometimes churn out 10,000 words in a night because we were mad about what happened in the news that day. We can understand too. So what were some of the things that you were blogging about in the early days that were, you know, you thought they made sense, but everyone in the consensus of city planners thought you were a heretic?
It was very geeky stuff. You go back and read those early ones. There's a lot of technical data and things in there that, you know, show up every now and then now, but the center point then was like, here's a road on a cul-de-sac, and here's how much it costs to build, and here's how much taxes you get back. And look, for every dollar taxes you get back, it costs you $3. That doesn't make sense. And, you know, it was interesting because I did, in that first year, I probably did 25 different case studies like this. So like one every other week, I would pump out. You know, they would just go in and they were ridiculous. I mean, they were just crazy. And I would get this feedback of like, well, Chuck, you're not, you know, factoring in this and you're not factoring in that. And so I would come back and I would say, you know, look, here's factoring in, you know, this other thing that you complained about. Here's this other thing. And I built this like overwhelming amount of data to show how crazy this was. It was basically like just going back through all the stuff that I had been shouting at these city council meetings, you know, and being told to just mind my own business. It was releasing that out into the public in a way that was kind of angry, you know, like, why wouldn't anyone listen to this? But also, you know, when I started to get feedback from other professionals around the country who said, yeah, I see this exact same thing. It was also therapeutic and like deeply satisfying. Like, wow, I'm not crazy.
Would it be fair to say that if we zoomed out and said, what do a lot of these crazy things in the consensus have in common, is that it's the hope that if you build a big, large project, like a giant development, it will solve all the city's problems. And you were saying, you know, building that big office park, bringing in that big box retail, doing that big development, building that giant road is actually going to lose money in the long run. Would that be a fair summary? Or how would you summarize what all these little different things you saw a bunch of towns doing had in common?
I actually think it's slightly more insidious than that. And I say that in like a kind way. I mean, as a person who, when I did engineering work, I believed in the bottom of my heart that I was making the cities I was working with strong, healthy, prosperous, that I was doing like great things, not only for the firm I work for and for myself as an engineer, but for the cities I work with and the communities. I thought I was benefiting people. To uncover that and actually recognize that what I was doing certainly benefited me, certainly benefited the firm I was working for, I think you could argue had some political benefit for the politicians who are getting these projects done. But long-term was like a financial millstone around the community's neck. It allowed the community to live on like a financial sugar high with this long-term like thing that was going to wear them down. I went through a period of time where I felt horrible about that. Like I felt deeply guilty about it. Trying to share this with other people, you kind of get back to that Upton Sinclair quote, you know, the famous one, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it. That was a lot of what I dealt with, is that this system works really well for the people who are working in it. The professionals, the politicians, developers, it works really well for the people connected to it. And to get them to understand how, like, yes, it works really well today, but 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, it's going to kill us. It's a really hard sell.
So let's get into the like technics of what is driving this, you know, what is the to use the Upton Sinclair quote, like, who are the people profiting from this and pushing these bad city planning decisions? So my sense is that it's like a real estate developer comes to the town planner and says, you know, we could build a subdivision here if you put in this. The town planner wants to feel like he's doing something, and the politician wants to cut a ribbon and say that we've had action in our town. Is that the big triumvirate? It's the developer wanting just to build something to profit, the design consultants that, you know, get the fee no matter if it's good or not. The planner wants to feel like he or she's doing something, and the politicians want to cut a ribbon? Or is there other forces at play?
Let's make this a little more uncomfortable for what I suspect is your audience, but I could be wrong. But let me make this a little bit more uncomfortable, because I do think that there's an aspect of everything you said. I think there's part of that. But a lot of it, especially a lot of what I was seeing in the cities that I worked with, which tended to be more small or mid-sized places, was that the government, the state government, the federal government, was this destructive force. I'll give you the crazy story that I worked on as an engineer. This is like an extreme case, but it's almost the extreme cases that help us see more clearly. I was working in a small town, and they had a leaky pipe. Leaky pipe ran under the highway. And I went out in the middle of the night as an engineer, and like literally this is what you do. You pull off manhole covers and you stick a thing down there and measure how much flow is going through. And if you think of a city at 1 a.m, there shouldn't be that much flow, right? Where you'd find it, that's where the pipes were leaking. And I actually got it down to, there was one little stretch of pipe. It was $300,000 to fix and replace that. This city was broke. The federal government in the 1960s had built them a water system, a sewer system, you know, out of kindness and general, you know, everybody should have equitable sewage treatment. How can we allow people to live without this? So they went out and built them this huge system. And I went back to the city council and they said, this is great, Chuck. Our total budget for a year is $100,000. We don't have $300,000 to fix this pipe. You're going to have to figure something out. There are grant agencies. There are state and federal programs to help with this stuff. I went to all of them and I gave them this project. And every single one said, this is maintenance. Maintenance is a local issue. We don't deal with maintenance. You're going to have to figure this one out. So I asked, what do you do? You know, you've got this grant program. You give away millions of dollars a year. What do you do? And they went through, like, we do things for environmental reasons, for economic development, for social justice. Here's all of our criteria. So I went back to the city, and I was at the time like a 24, 25-year-old engineer. I'm a smart guy. I know how to, you know, work this. So I went back and I found where the poorest people in town were. I came up with a project to run sewer out to their places, hook them up. We ran it by a place where we could have future economic growth. We had a pending environmental catastrophe because our sewage treatment ponds were going to overflow. We put together this thing that met all the checklists for a $2.6 million project that, oh, by the way, also repaired this one little 300 feet of pipe. All of a sudden, my project shot up to the top of the funding list. Federal government wanted to fund it. State government wanted to fund it. Of the $2.6 million, we got $2.47 million in grant. And the rest of it was funded by the federal government at a low interest, below market rate interest loan over 40 years. When we signed this deal, no one on the city council was under 60 years old. So none of them were ever going to see this loan paid back. I got a big bonus from my company for delivering this. Like, they called me the rainmaker for a while because, you know, like, I delivered this huge project. The city actually had Chuck Marone Day because I saved them, you know, from this huge problem. I'm not joking you. This was like in every bit of feedback that I got from the funding agencies to the city to my business, to my company that I work for, everybody was thrilled about this. Step back and look at what happened. I took a city that had a system built for them in the 60s that was too big for them to afford to maintain. And in order to deal with a short-term maintenance issue, I doubled the size of their system, basically. So I bought them some time, right? But the millstone around their neck is just way worse. At some point, this is going to drag them down and they're not going to be able to fix it. Now, multiply that over neighborhood, city, states, all over the country, and you've got basically the trade-off. We can fix our problems today by creating these massive unfunded things in the future. And it's not a matter of not having the commitment to build infrastructure. We built a ton of infrastructure. It's just that the lack of productivity, the lack of like return on that investment is so pitiful, so low that, you know, we're creating a situation where there's no way cities can keep up.
Let me unpack this a bit. So we usually think about liabilities in terms of loans, and there's liabilities from the loan to build this. So you're going to have to pay back that loan as a town. But there's also the maintenance liability of when you build a big infrastructure system, you not only have to pay back the loan for it being built, you also have to pay for all the maintenance that comes from this.
Now you're talking crazy talk. Yeah. Because like that makes sense, right? I mean, you and I can logically sit here and say today, if we go out and build a new road, we're going to have to go fix a road in 25 years, right? As an engineer, like that's not hard to figure out. Like we should actually be able to say, if we accept this road today, 25 years from now, here's the cost, and be fairly accurate on it. There's no like complex, weird math. Cities are required to, and this is general accounting practices set up by state governments, sanctioned by the federal government. Like this is the way we want you to account for these things. A road is considered an asset, not a liability. So when you build a road, you're actually on the balance sheet getting richer. There's no thought given to how much return you get, how much tax base you create, how much you have to spend in the future to maintain that. All these things would be part of, in a private sector, part of the way you would do accounting. No, we treat it. So we actually encourage, you actually have a stronger balance sheet as a city. You're financially considered healthier and in better shape. You can get a better bond rating the more roads you have, even if it results in no building, no business, nothing. That's crazy talk, but that's how we have created this system.
It's almost totally bipartisan, non-profound statement to say, let's just build a bunch of stuff and everyone can agree on that. Building infrastructure is seen as probably like the only thing in the Trump era that could have been passed. But you're trying to complicate that and say, actually, you know, hey, there are some people who think kind of mindless building infrastructure is a problem. So the question is, what is the alternative? You know, when should we build a road? Because I assume at some points we should, it would be good for a city to build a bridge or a road or even an office park. So how do you tell the difference?
The reason why we have this bipartisan paradigm on infrastructure is because there's agreement among, and I think, you know, you can look left and right, but I think you have to look at it in terms of centralizing or localizing. Among centralizing forces, which there's centralizing forces on the right and on the left, infrastructure building solves a big short-term problem. You can create a lot of growth by building infrastructure. If you're interested in pumping up GDP, in lowering unemployment, and creating a lot of growth very quickly, you can reach across the aisle and figure out how to go out and build a bunch of infrastructure and make that happen. If you are more locally oriented and your focus is on how do we build like healthy cities, how do we build human habitat, local ecosystems that generate wealth and prosperity for people, it's a very different equation. I would only build that road if I could generate not only enough tax base to sustain that investment, you know, to take care of it over multiple life cycles, but that tax base was going to be stable, adaptable, flexible. If you think of a big box store or a, you know, franchise drive-through restaurant, those things have very limited reuse. They are one building. They have one kind of function. If you build a big Walmart building, you're not going to be repurposing that tomorrow into something else. Certainly not something more valuable if that Walmart decides to move or close or do whatever, which happens very frequently. If you build a kind of small downtown box, just like a little, think of your core downtown and whatever that looks like, there's a bunch of little buildings that essentially are boxes. That box can be a restaurant, it can be an attorney's office, it can be a place where you get your hair cut, it can be, you know, whatever. These buildings are very adaptable and flexible. So to me, when I look at infrastructure, what I'm looking at is what at the local level can we afford to sustain and take care of? And is what we're building there going to be there over the long term to help in that task? And you can just draw a line, really, pre-Depression, post-World War II. The stuff we've built after post-World War II has this strong horizontal component that just accelerates exponentially as you go further away from that 1945 split. And essentially, none of that has the financial characteristics that you see in pre-war development of adaptability, flexibility, high financial productivity. And the stuff we built the last 20 years is just bizarre along those lines.
So what do you mean by horizontal nature to the post-war stuff? So post-war, well, bad, pre-war good. Yeah. What are the qualities that make post-war bad?
Let me give you two ways to think about this, because this is actually an easy one to grasp, and then you'll start to see it all over the place. Think of like a shotgun shack, you know, a pretty standard poor person's way of building prior to the Great Depression. What you have is you have basically a skinny building that's very deep. And the reason you would build a skinny building that is very deep is because you all of the poor people in that neighborhood that are going to be building those original shacks, you collectively are going to have to pay to maintain the sidewalk and the street and the pipe and all the public infrastructure in front of your place. You're going to have to pay for that together. So the way you split up those costs and make it so you can all afford it is you put a lot of homes on the street. You make your house really skinny and then you make it deep. If you look just after World War II, we began building ranch homes. Ranch homes were like the 1950s and 60s style of building. And what does a ranch home do? It takes the shotgun shack and it just turns it sideways. It says our lots are going to be really wide and shallow. Right.
So it's literally horizontal, you know, like literally the literally shape of the building tells you something about how we're funding them and how we're structuring.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay.
Exactly. So all of a sudden, you know, you're like, we didn't care whether we could afford it or not. Like it, like you just assumed that we were always going to be rich and like you could build this stuff and amateurize it over 30 years and no one had to care. You didn't have to care about it. And so our houses just became wider and our lots became wider and shallower. It wasn't even that much more space that we were taking up. We were just doing it differently. It almost is like a grotesque, like, let's just throw away money because we can. Over time, that's gotten even, you know, more profound. So you can look at like the drive-in restaurants of the 50s and 60s, and they actually had a narrower footprint than the drive-in restaurants of today, which have very wide, expansive footprints, you know, with green space and stormwater retention basins around it and all this. It's a massive amount of money you spend per place, per unit.
Yeah, it's weird. When you go to like a drive-in McDonald's or something, there's like all the parking. I notice it when I'm driving with my dog because there's so many places to walk your dog at a drive-in McDonald's because it's surrounded by these like berms of grass. And I'm like, is McDonald's maintaining that? You know, it's not a very efficient use of space.
Well, and let me go back to making people uncomfortable again. A lot of this, the reaction to a lot of the craziness was an environmental push. I'll give you an engineering adage, and it crosses over into the environmentalism movement, particularly as it kind of manifests in the 80s and 90s. In engineering, we talk about dilution as a solution to pollution. The idea is that if you dilute things down, your particles per million go way down, and then you meet these pollution thresholds. The same kind of thinking has been applied to land. And it's like, well, we have a lack of green space. Well, let's require McDonald's to have a little bit of green space. Well, we have a lack of clean. Well, let's spread everybody out a little bit more. And the crazy thing is that a lot of the environmentalism of the 70s and 80s and 90s, particularly when I was dealing with it in the 90s, was kind of pernicious. If you came in and you said, we want to put 5 units per acre, the environmentalists would show up and say, well, that's a big impact in one spot. We think you should be 2 units per acre. The reality is you still got 10 units. You just got them over 5 times the area. You spread things out more. I do think that the environmentalism movement has gotten more sophisticated in the last decade or two, although you still run into this, you know, the Sierra Club in California is kind of notorious for this, you know, not wanting to basically make cities even more urban, you know, as a response. And so you wind up, the further you get out from the core and the newer the development gets, the more it has these kind of underlying horizontal inducing components to them that, I think are the worst of the worst, no matter how you measure it.
Because it seems like it's like faux green space. Like I'd rather have Central Park surrounded by super dense, you know, blocks than have like one tiny little berm of green space in between the McDonald's that doesn't seem like a pleasant place to be anyway. Is that seem to be the spirit?
Yeah. This was my realization the first time I went to Italy, right? So I went to Italy the first time in like 2000. And I live in Minnesota, so like the shoreline here is the place to develop. I spent 10 years of my career working with people largely who are developing shoreline. And the state rules for shoreline basically suburbanize the shoreline. You've got to have 100 foot per lot. If you're going to put a granny shack in, you've got 180 feet per lot. And it was basically all about splitting up the shoreline. And anytime you tried to do something that was more urban in character, the state would like jump down your throat. You can't do this. The DNR would actually sue, the Department of Natural Resources here in Minnesota would actually sue you. So I go to Italy and I'm going to like Lake Como. And on Lake Como, you know, here's this little town of Stresa. It's just gorgeous. It's beautiful. It is intense. It is urban. It is like very, very intense. But it occupies like 1/100th of the shoreline. And the other 99% of the shore is all natural and gorgeous and like shared collectively. And I'm like, wow, this is beautiful. What have we done? What we did is we focused on growth. How do we grow as quickly as we can and not really worry about the long-term ramifications of it?
So I want to do two concepts that you share in your stump speech that I have not been able to get out of my mind that illuminate some of these points very concretely. So the first was, and this is the anytime I'm pitching you, Chuck, I always use this example first, which is you showed a picture of a pizza place. And you showed a picture of like a Best Buy or a Walmart parking lot. And the pizza place was like very, very tiny. It was like an eighth of an acre or something. It was like one of those pizza places where you walk in and the sign's right
Jimmy's
in front
pizza.
Of you. Jimmy's Pizza. And you go and you get a slice and they're all right in front of you and everyone's cramped in. And then there's some, what is it? A Kmart parking lot or something?
Yeah, it's like there's a Kmart and a Walmart.
Yeah, giant parking lot, giant imprint. And you then show the amount per acre in wealth that is generated by these two things. And you're like, oh, well, the Walmart must be bigger. It's selling everything, whereas pizza's just selling slice. But because they're successfully making use of that eighth of an acre to sell a lot of pizza, they're actually generating 10x or something more. So could you share that story a bit?
Yeah. Because of the way we have built, we've come to kind of equate big with successful. And the reality is like any farmer can tell you that it's not the amount of acreage you till, it's the productivity of that acreage. You know, how much are you getting back per acre? If you've got good soil and if you've got good irrigation and if you get a good summer of sun, you can generate a lot per acre, you know, in a small plot of land. If you've got a large piece of land and you don't have very good conditions, it doesn't matter. You're not going to produce all that much. What Jimmy's Pizza demonstrates is that when we were poorer as a country, before we had the prolificacy to kind of just grow horizontally, what we built was not only very frugal, but incredibly productive. It has a productivity of $3.4 million per acre. So that's basically, if you have an acre of land that's developed in the style of that Jimmy's Pizza, which is a rundown kind of a shack of a pizza place. There's nothing spectacular about it, nothing like great about it. It's going to generate $3.4 million of wealth for the community. If you look at that Kmart, which is the one I kind of juxtaposed with it, the Kmart is at $350,000 an acre. So basically Jimmy's Pizza is 10 times more productive than the Kmart. And you look at that and you're like, well, yeah, but Kmart is like our biggest taxpayer. Kmart pays a ton of sales tax and a ton of property tax. And Jimmy's Pizza only generates this small little amount. And like that's very true. But Kmart's also, you know, utilizing like all of your land. Like they're using a ton. You've got millions of dollars of pipe in the ground. You've got millions of dollars of road and street and curb and sidewalk. You've got like a ton of money committed to it. What we have done, and my friend Joe Minicozzi is the one who I think has perfected this kind of way of thinking about things. He's a planner with Urban 3. His firm does a lot of these visual analyses. He pointed out if we were going to take this mentality and take it to automobiles, you would say like the Ford F-150 is the greatest car because, you know, it can get you like 600 miles per tank of gas. But your tank of gas in the Ford F-150 is like, you know, 60 gallons or 80 gallons. If you go to, you know, my little car is not going to get you as far per tank, but miles per gallon, it's like 35 miles a gallon. You know, it's a far more productive use of land. If our goal as a city is to build places that are prosperous and viable over the long term, you've got to focus on productivity, not just size.
So you're talking about it in terms of finances and taxes, but like my lefty softy heart, it's like the places you love in the town, like the spiritual aspect of this for a town is also very important. No one, you know, when they're away, or if, to use James Howard Kunstler's extreme example, when you're deployed fighting in a war and you're thinking back about home, no one dreams of, I want to get home, I'm fighting for my home of the Kmart parking lot. They dream of, I'm fighting for Joe's Pizza. And I've seen it, you know, with, there's almost this reverse thing happening in a place nearby to me. It's like the Chuck Marone dream example. There's literally an abandoned Kmart, and this one tiny development group got like 1/16th corner of it. They put in a front door, they built a food hall, they called it the block, and they got 5 local restaurants to open up inside of the food hall, and it's filled with like 150 people in this tiny space every night, and it's beloved. And it's like slowly turning an unlovable, unproductive place. You could slowly start imagining taking them all back and building these tiny little lovable, productive places.
Here's what I saw on the ground, going to council meeting after council meeting, literally thousands of them over a career doing this stuff, is that the person like you would show up. And they would give the heart story, you know, like, oh, this pulls at your heartstrings. And look at this local entrepreneur. I had one city I worked in where a guy owned a local grocery store. And he had struggled. He was trying to make ends meet. The big chain grocery store came in on the outside of town, wanted $800,000 of subsidies to open up this new grocery store. And the city was going to give it to him. And this local grocer said, wait a sec. Like, I would love to do this like thing and redo my grow. And I'm here. I've been in this community. My family's been here for generations. If you would give me like a third of that, I'd be happy to, like, here's what I could create. And I could create a new butcher here and all this. And the city council basically threw him out. They said, no, we want the growth. It's funny because a lot of the way that your argument, you know, like, this is what I like. This is the culture that I like. You know, my lefty, like, let's all get along and work together. It gets thrown out because it's seen as like a loser economic bet. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's the math that matters. And what we've found at Strong Towns is that we've got the math wrong. And there's actually like far more alignment at the local level between your kind of happy neighborhood, let's all work together, kind of leftist utopia vision, and the accountant, prude, number crunching, we got to make this work kind of vision. They actually, at the local level, align really well, really, really well.
Yeah, I want to hear a bit more about that, because I assume some folks that are listening are going in and out pro anti-Chuck as they're hearing this, but hopefully they've learned to trust you, because first you're saying the environmentalists are ruining everything. People need to understand about your tax liabilities, you know, don't be doing these big federal grants. But then you're saying like Walmart is ruining our towns and the centralizers are doing these things and we need to fight back against the corporations for the local businesses. So you're a very heterodox character. And, you know, it's interesting. I really think about this a lot with my fellow lefty strategists. It's like, we need to put front and center, and you don't have to be with this because I know it, you're not from this side of the spectrum. But, you know, I always say like the best of the left is like Vermont and the Bronx. It's real neighborhoods that, you know, both of those places vote like 80% Democrat, but they're much better than like these suburban kind of snobby places, which are usually front and center, you know, the suburban Palo Alto or something. And what did Vermont and the Bronx, you know, understand is they understand that localism matters and that, you know, the heart of your community might be this, our local entrepreneurs and local people that love the town. And I'd love to hear a bit about how you've experienced this totally new dividing line of localist responsible versus centralizing liability making, and how that plays out in the common left-right spectrum in your advocacy over the last 10 years.
Yeah, this has been probably the hardest thing to bridge for me, because I grew up, I think I discovered Rush Limbaugh in like my last year of high school and listened to him all through college. And I mean, that was like in the early 90s. When I first got to vote in 92 was my first presidential election. I voted for George Bush and I couldn't stand Bill Clinton. I'm a very like Republican-minded person. We have the caucus system here. So you kind of have to declare a party, and then it's not a passive thing like where you can just show up and vote in a primary. You have to go and show up and talk to people. And you know, those people can be kind of crazy. So, you know, I got initiated pretty early. And I have to say, in my engineering years and my early planning years, I was very much like a market oriented. The more efficient we can make a market, the more centralized we can make a market, the better it's going to be for everyone. And yeah, the ATM might put the person at the bank, you know, out of business who, you know, used to give me my money. I can just go to the ATM now. But hey, this is progress, and progress comes with a price. When I started getting into and digging into the Strong Town stuff, I started from the financial standpoint. But I started to ask some very human questions, right? Like, why do we do this? Why do we struggle in this way? And almost like deferring to the ancient wisdom of how we build places was also an acknowledgement of the ancient wisdom of how we, in a sense, commune and get along in this human habitat. And I've started to recognize, you know, both through kind of my Catholicism. I grew up Catholic and I'm still Catholic. My family goes to Catholic church regularly, but also just in the fact that I'm in the struggle, right? Like, I live in a city and I'm actively involved, and I know these local business entrepreneurs, and I know what they're going through. I've started to recognize the importance of a kind of broader way of approaching issues that are local. The thing you run into, and I want to put this front and center, the more local you get, the more parochial you become. And the more what I call like the Bubba kind of action you get, you know, I feel like one of the whole big parts of progressivism is that if we can make like the laws in Alabama the same as the laws in New York State, the same as the laws in rural Montana, it's the same as the laws in California, we can have a just, equitable world. And I just like that side of my brain, the conservative side, just rejects that. But I also have come to reject the opposite side, that if we can just have like the markets in Montana be connected to the markets in California and be connected to the markets in New York and the markets in Alabama, that this will be just and work well, and everybody will get ahead and, you know, will benefit over the long term. I've really come to recognize that as a problem. And so I don't know where that puts us. I've said, I had to give a speech a couple of years ago on conservatives in urban planning. And I noted in that speech, and I put it at the end of my book too, that I've got coming out here soon. If we go to the national level, I'm pretty libertarian. When we get to the state, I tend to be kind of like a Minnesota Republican, which is like a prudent, let's make things work, but let's not commit to something for 100 years. You know, let's test things out and bring data. But by the time I get to like the neighborhood level, I'm pretty much like a socialist. I'm pretty much a communitarian, you know? Like, if my neighbor needs something, come and get it. You know, whatever I've got is yours. You know, let's all work together and figure this out. I haven't quite reconciled how that fits in to the American paradigm, because I do recognize that a lot of neighborhoods are struggling, and that the more local we get, the more parochial we can become. But I do feel like the places that I see embracing the Strong Towns message and the places that I see most vigorously working at it to try to improve tend to have a high correlation with poverty. If you're a poor neighborhood and you can go out and instead of having to put in a $200,000 sprinkler system and $100,000 improvements to make this little box work so you can try out your new business, instead of having to go to the secondary market and finance something through Wall Street, you can actually go to a local bank, you can get a head start, you can make something of yourself. Those are the places that are embracing Strong Towns the most vigorously today. And I didn't expect that when I started, but I'm really, really encouraged by it.
Well, that's one thing that I saw in what you're doing. We like to talk on this podcast a lot about what I call the democratic faith in the genius of ordinary citizens. What you showed in your stump speech that first turned me on to this was that often in these places that some central planner or central real estate developer, private or public central planner, would see as like a blighted neighborhood or some blighted strip mall, was actually like a place of deep local knowledge and genius. You know, the way that North African immigrant down Route 7 in my region, they've had the strip mall for 70 years. And it would, if a heartless real estate developer was looking at it, be like, oh, that's the place I want to build my Walmart because nothing's happening there. If you actually go inside, there's religious services happening there. There's all these stores. They figured out this own thing. They've come together and built an interesting civic organization to deal with collective things. They're having educational things there, and there's lawyers there to help with immigration things. It's like this amazing ecosystem that is underneath the surface because people disrespect ordinary people.
Let me give you a very concrete example of this that was profound to me. I got a chance to go to Memphis, Tennessee and do a lot of work with them there. This was like 2013, 2014. So early in the Strong Towns kind of conversation. And we had put together this map for them, showing them their financially most productive neighborhoods. Where's the neighborhoods where dollar per acre you're getting the most return? And we went down and sat down with the mayor, a guy named A.C. Wharton, black from South Memphis, really like proud, a great leader. Like I liked A.C. a lot. I liked him a lot. I got to know him a little bit and he was a great guy. We sat down and showed him South Memphis generates more tax revenue for you per acre, the poorest neighborhood in your community, than these new wealthy subdivisions you're building out on the edge. That like floored him. He did not believe, and this is a guy who's from those neighborhoods, right? Like gets those, like ran saying, I want to represent these disenfranchised people in this neighborhood. And he had a hard time. And we sat down, we went through it, and we explained to him, like, this is what's going on. And it was devastating because the city had been doing everything they could to get these new developments out on the edge and bring in this new, you know, the gated communities and the, you know, the big hotel franchises and the new restaurant franchises and the big box stores. And the theory was if we could just do enough of that out there, we'd have money to help these poor neighborhoods. When the reality is the poor neighborhoods were the ones paying the freight. The poor neighborhoods were the ones generating more tax revenue than any of the new stuff that was going on. They were actually like profitable. Here's the scary thing, or the sad thing maybe. You go out to those neighborhoods and like you say, there's such vibrancy and life in these places. People are finding a way, despite being neglected and despite all the decline and despite people walking away from them, to make a community and make it work really well. The question becomes, what if we just gave a damn? Like, what if we just went out and instead of trying to like transform the place overnight, what if we just said, you know, where are people struggling and what are like the next little thing we can do here to make this better? When we can do that, you actually meet people where they are. You're dealing with them in reality, not some theory like here's our big project we can do that will fix things for you. You're actually humbling yourself in an important way to say like, I don't know, but I'm going to be a servant to your needs. And I really think that's a transformation we need right now.
And from what I've heard from what you've written before, the way that that works in practice is usually, you know, going to these neighborhoods, asking what they need and giving, you know, small grants to do the incremental improvements. It seems like your alternative to this type of development, your positive story is incremental development, one step at a time based on what the neighborhood sees that it wants. Is that a correct way to say it?
I would go a step further than that. And you said, you know, give grants or micro grants or whatever. I think there's a model that involves that. But I actually think if we're talking about government, I think cities right now orient up the government food chain. We look at the government as like a food chain where the federal government spews money, the state government spews money, and the local governments try to catch that. Like, how can we align ourselves to get the most money from the state and federal government? And they will do crazy things in order to make that happen. Right now in my hometown, we're angling for a children's museum because that's like the hot thing that the state is funding now. We have such desperate needs throughout our neighborhoods. The idea of a children's museum is absurd, but it's the thing that like the front row people can get paid to do. What I'm talking about is government as like servants of people. So we go out, right outside my door here is the poorest neighborhood in town. We go out into this neighborhood and we actually humble ourselves to not pretend we have the answer, but to say, where are people in this neighborhood struggling right now? We have to go out and observe that. We have to like literally walk a mile in their shoes. We've done this in neighborhoods before where you walk with people and you say, talk to me about where you're going. What are you doing? What are you having difficulty here with? And we try to kind of incrementally, and think of it like a fast reaction kind of way, we go out and we make improvements. It's hard to get across the street here. Well, is there something we could do with cones and flags and flashers right now on the cheap that would make that easier for you? And we do those things. And what we find is that in human habitat, which is a complex adaptive systems, people will start to respond to our small changes. And those things will give us the key, the feedback, the direction that we need to continue to iterate incrementally and to really serve these places. I think cities need to orient themselves instead of looking up the government food chain and saying, where can we catch the most crumbs coming down? They need to orient themselves down to the block and the neighborhood level and say, how do we be like servants of these places?
This is a wonderful message. I'm going to end here with two more things, which is we always like doing rapid fire questions at the end. And then I want to give you a chance to plug the book. So I'm going to just ask some rapid fire questions that might be on listeners' minds having heard this to just hear your quick take on them. I got five right here. First off, what's your take on bikes versus cars? Do radical bike activists have a role in the Strong Towns mission?
Yes, absolutely. And anytime you can get someone biking instead of driving, the city's making money. They're printing money. And anytime you get someone walking instead of biking, you're printing money. So yeah, absolutely.
And the reason that you're printing money is because they stop and shop at stores because they're not stuck in their car. Is that why?
No, it's because it's a radically different system. It's a radically different city, one that serves bicycles than automobiles, and it's massively more productive. Any space you waste parking cars is a massive drain on your financial productivity.
Second, smart growth, this idea that we should have these big mixed-use developments around like metro stations.
I think it's the way that lefties pretend they're doing something. I'm not a fan. And I'm not a fan because I think it emphasizes all the wrong things. There's some alignment there with smart growth and strong towns, but I'm generally like not a fan.
European plazas, this dream that we could be like these European cities where the central downtown is like these beautiful open walking spaces.
Beautiful dream. And I think we can imagine that and like incrementally work towards it. I think if we go in and build that as like step one and then hope that everything else kind of evolves around it, we're missing something. Definitely work towards that. But I think that that as a catalyst is the wrong way to think about it.
The Amazon HQ2 fight, how did you feel as someone who seems to be completely oriented against that? That must have been hard to watch.
Yeah, I signed a petition with Richard Florida and a bunch of other people calling on cities to opt out voluntarily. To me, it was sad to see what should be the strongest part of our government ecosystems, that being local governments, grovel in that way. I am firmly of the belief that if we're going to have a strong country, it needs to be based on a foundation of strong cities, towns, and neighborhoods. It's not the other way around. We don't have success at the top and have it trickle down. And to have our cities just manifestly be so desperate was very painful. Yeah.
Final rapid fire question before we get to the book. What is the strongest town in America? Who should we all be looking towards? I know you got to choose a favorite. Yep.
Yeah, this year it's Pensacola. We have a contest every year where we name a strongest town. They go through a bracket style competition. This year at Pensacola, Florida, which, you know, there's a lot of things not good about Pensacola, but there's a lot of things well, like really great about it. And I think even more so, some of the practices that they're doing and putting in place to incrementally iterate off of success, to build a strong downtown, to connect it to their surrounding neighborhoods. These are great best practices. So yeah, Pensacola is our strongest town of 2019.
Wonderful. We'll all be looking up Pensacola. To end this, you have a book coming out. You did it in a very strong towns way, where instead of starting your movement with a book, you incrementally built your thoughts to a book, and you finally are ready to do it 10 years in, which is Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. Tell us a bit about the book, when we can get it, where we can get it.
It's going to be released on October 1st, but you can pre-order it now anywhere that you can get books. You can go to strongtowns.org and there's a bunch of links there to where you can get it. I'm really proud of this book. I, for many years, kind of start and stopped of writing a book, and I couldn't find the right partner, the right publisher, the right person who got what we were doing. Wiley Publishing came along and they were the right fit at the right time. If you're interested in this conversation, this book is going to challenge you. It's going to inspire you. And I'm really, I wish it came out tomorrow, because I have so many people that I want to get it in front of and be able to get like the Strong Towns message run deep. So thank you.
We will put the pre-order in the show notes for any of you listening, and also the link to your movement, strongtowns.org. It's a very participatory movement. So if you were really taken by this interview, listeners, you can join up and fight for this in your own town. Chuck, thank you so much for coming on Current Affairs.
Pete, it's fantastic to talk to you, and I hope we keep in touch.
Same. Thank you.